Hey everyone, welcome back. Today we're continuing our conversation with Somil Trivedi about the impacts of COVID-19 within correctional facilities. I'm Bhavna.
And I'm Vendela. And this is Women's Health Incarcerated. So Somil, the initial stages of this pandemic in March were characterized by a great deal of uncertainty. In fact, when we spoke in May, you touched on how there was a lack of data and information surrounding how facilities were responding to COVID. Since then, how has information or facilities' responses to the pandemic developed?
So sadly, we do not have much more information about how detention centers are treating folks and preventing them from getting COVID than we did at the beginning. In fact, if anything, they've become more tight-lipped because they know they're failing. And so outside of a few facilities where they've been sued and therefore discovery has unearthed some information, or they're in a jurisdiction where activists have been able to coax periodic reporting on very, very high level pieces of information like the daily positive rate or the death rate, we largely don't know what's going on inside the black boxes of jails and prisons and ICE detention centers. But I know from my work that it is a very grim picture, and that whatever minimal steps they are taking, barely complying with CDC guidance, which is itself not as strong as it needs to be, they're not working. We know that the numbers are spiking on the outside, but they are spiking even more dramatically on the inside.
So what measures, if any, have been put in place to mitigate the spread of COVID-19?
So virtually nothing. If you asked a jail, they would say that they have maybe reduced intakes a little bit. That's a good thing. Maybe they've handed out masks. Maybe they've started wiping down communal phones. All of those are commendable and yet a bit like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, because what they have not done and actually have refused to do, actively refused, is reduce the population such that social distancing is even possible, right? We touched on overcrowding earlier. Even at under capacity, even at 50% of capacity, these places are just not big enough for you to consistently stay 6 feet from another person. Everybody involved knows that. The jailers know that, we know that, the judges know that, the public knows that. And yet, we have dehumanized these people so much that we don't care, that society has given up on trying to allow them to do the one thing that all of the rest of us are doing, or at least allowed to do. And so all of those other measures will not ultimately stop the spread inside these facilities, because we refuse to do the one thing that is necessary. And it is out of an inability to grasp their fundamental humanity.
So clearly, the measures that have been put in place haven't been working.
No, they haven't. Rates have continued to skyrocket in these facilities. And, you know, much like in the greater population, they don't even do universal testing to the point where we could know how bad it is in there. So every little bit helps. I do not want to discourage any facility from increasing the use of PPE, expanding testing, doing whatever they can to socially distance. But none of it is going to ultimately save people and, oh, by the way, comply with what the Constitution requires.
Right. Exactly. And can you also speak on how the experience of incarceration has been changed by the pandemic?
That's a good question. Prison life right now is, as I said earlier, even more terrifying than it normally is. And facilities' responses has often been to just lock them down, right? So folks are basically living in what mimics segregation, what mimics solitary all the time. Only half an hour of recreation a day, minimal programming, switching to sack lunches instead of hot food. And while, again, some of this is meant to be a response to the pandemic, it is not saving them from the pandemic. It's just making the situation worse. And maybe the most impactful progression is that folks have been cut off from their legal representation in many cases. It has become exceedingly difficult for lawyers to communicate with their clients, at least until folks raise a stink about it. And therefore, they don't have any information about how to save themselves. And that's when one of the scariest things, when we finally get through to our clients, they feel like they're on an island, they feel abandoned, and they're right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like the increased lack of legal representation that incarcerated folks are experiencing hasn't been crossing a lot of people's minds. So expanding on that, how have families of incarcerated people and the community in general also been impacted by the situation with COVID?
That's a good question. The families we've spoken to are terrified. They don't have enough information. They know that often their family members who are inside are particularly susceptible to COVID, right? Because once again, we over-rely on the criminal system to address issues like public health, right? Therefore, the population inside is older and sicker than the general population, and therefore they're more susceptible to COVID than we are. And so the families are really, really scared, and they haven't been able to communicate as often as they need to. They believe that their country has abandoned their families again, and they're right. And so this is a sort of microcosm an amplification of what incarceration does. It destroys entire families. It doesn't just punish a single person. And so if we're trying to think about net benefit, what have we done to these communities by separating them from their family members for so long without regard to their health? This is the result.
So I know you briefly mentioned earlier how jails have reduced intakes slightly, but have there been any more measures taken in terms of releasing people from facilities to reduce the spread of this virus? And how are these decisions being made?
So almost nothing has been done to affect the widespread, wide-scale release of individuals from either jails or prisons or ICE detention centers. It has primarily required lawsuits. Many of those lawsuits have not been successful in getting people out. They have been successful in pressuring the facilities to take other measures, and in some cases, like I said, reduce intakes in the first place. But in terms of coming to grips with the fundamental problem that you cannot socially distance in prisons and jails, they have done virtually nothing. And what makes this even more galling for people is that they see stories like Michael Cohen getting out because of COVID, right? And let me be very clear, I'm glad Michael Cohen got out because of COVID. I don't want to see him die in prison any more than I want to see anybody else die. His humanity, regardless of what you think he did or who he served, is still valuable, and he ought to have gotten out. But when you see a Michael Cohen get out or a Roger Stone get out, and you don't see the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of Black and brown people get out, then you start to think that these decisions aren't being made on the basis of public health or merit. They're made based on favors, and you might be right. And that would cause you to lose trust in our criminal justice system, even if you haven't already. And that has really detrimental long-term effects. So I want everybody to be treated like Michael Cohen. I want these decisions to be made on the basis of public health and the Constitution and nothing more. And if we did that, we'd see a lot more releases than we have till now.
Chronic illnesses and even pregnancy have been related to poorer outcomes from COVID-19. How are these health factors being considered when making decisions about release?
They are not. And that's probably the saddest and most perverse thing about this pandemic and its effect on the criminal justice system. And it's also the most illuminating, right? So rather than going through your population and deciding who is at highest risk and then taking that into consideration, instead, we are operating out of a tough on crime 1980s playbook where we simply look at what crime people have committed or what crimes they have been convicted of in the past and decide it as if it's any other release decision. That is not only wrong as a matter of public health, but it reflects the bias of our system, because our system has been searching out, hunting down, and over-incarcerating these people for so long. of course, now they are going to look like the kind of people who don't, quote unquote, deserve to be out, right? So it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so that is where, as we, you know, as we started the show with, that is where mass incarceration and COVID intersect, right? Is that we have been targeting especially marginalized people of color for so long that we can no longer see them as human beings with health problems. They are merely criminals with more or less potential harm to public safety inside of them, which we know is absolutely wrong.
Right. And the way that we're treating these individuals right now is just an exacerbation of how we've always been treating them, like they aren't human. So what would you like to see being done in the coming months of this pandemic?
So we've touched on some of these, but obviously far more releases, responsible releases. Now, I want to be clear about this. When I say I want to release somebody from a jail or prison, I want them immediately to be doing the things that other responsible people are doing: isolation, monitoring, testing if needed, right? Testing if available. So anyone who claims that we just want to throw open the jailhouse doors, that is a false narrative. What we want to do is save people's lives, including people in the community. And that would not be served if we let people who are potentially infected with COVID get out and not do all of the things that we are doing. That said, first and foremost, they need to be out to do that. So far more releases than we're seeing now. Mandatory improvements in social distancing for those who are not released, hygiene, etc., that is overseen by independent bodies, right? It is very clear that jailers and wardens cannot oversee themselves during this pandemic. They have lost their credibility in this area. Things are only getting worse. And while they may traditionally have discretion on day-to-day matters inside the jail, and that's traditionally what the law gives them, is deference for the day-to-day administration, this is both a public health and a constitutional crisis. So we can no longer leave them to their own devices. We need independent oversight. We also need better guidance from the CDC and other public health officials. So far, even the doctors and the scientists at those bodies have allowed themselves, whether consciously or not, to adopt the tough on crime, dehumanizing frame that we've been talking about, because all of their guidance is sort of, well, if it's possible, socially distance if it's feasible. If you can get them a mask, great, right? None of it is binding, and all of it sort of defers to what they believe is a natural state of existence inside jails and prisons, which is squalor. And they just sort of accept that squalor and give jails the mildest of guidance to reduce that squalor a little bit. That is not what public health guidance should be. It should be required, and it should be on par with what everybody else is doing. So if the CDC is saying absolutely wear a mask and absolutely keep 6 feet from each other outside of jails and prisons, it should be saying that inside jails and prisons. Otherwise, it's just accepting that these people are not human beings, which is not the case. And that leads me to my final point, which is, what would I like to see? I'd like a basic recognition that the humans in detention facilities are human and therefore worth saving, just like the rest of us. It doesn't matter what they did, or what you think they did, or what the criminal system says they did. The Constitution and basic humanity says they don't get to die for it.
So I want to delve into your work a bit more. I imagine the pandemic and the social unrest we are seeing in response to state violence has influenced your current day-to-day. So what kind of cases have you been handling in these past few months, and has your focus shifted at all?
So, you know, my focus is on reducing mass incarceration and systemic racism in the criminal legal system. And therefore, that work in some ways hasn't changed at all, right? We are still looking to hold police and prosecutors and sheriffs accountable for the ways that they were fueling those problems beforehand. So, you know, we bring lawsuits and we try to pass legislation and we try to write in the media and get on podcasts like this great podcast to raise awareness of these problems and come up with creative solutions for them. But obviously the pandemic and the movement for Black Lives that has seen a reawakening this summer has given us more urgency and refocused us in some particular ways. So I said above that my day job is typically working to reform the institution of prosecution. I now have had to shift focus to the people suffering in jails and prisons. It's not something I did before, but we have ramped up our work in that area. We filed dozens of cases nationwide, and it's been, an all hands on deck kind of situation. So, the mission stays the same, but we're reacting in real time to the overlapping epidemics that are hitting our society and doing our best to help those people most in need.
Definitely. So what can individuals like us do to advocate for incarcerated people and for communities directly impacted by this violence?
Yeah. Raising awareness through shows like this is vital. Continuing to call people entangled with the criminal justice system people and humans. You don't know how much that means because it is not currently the majority view in America that they are humans and worthy of respect and decency and dignity. So merely that little bit of activism goes a long way. But also, you can contact your local officials. We tend to use this misnomer, the criminal justice system, as if there's one system, but there's actually thousands of them all across America. And criminal justice reform is sort of a quintessentially state by state, even county by county, city by city effort. Because each of them have their own prosecutors and their own police departments and their own jails. And so that can be simultaneously daunting because you've got to work across thousands of disparate systems. But it's really empowering because every individual can have a real impact on their community and they can make real change. So vote in elections like for sheriff and for prosecutor. Maybe you've never done that before. Maybe you didn't even know that your local prosecutor is elected. They are, and you can vote. You can vote them out if they are not implementing the criminal justice system that you want to see. Indeed, you can run for it. And I mean it. We need bold, new, progressive leaders to rethink our system at the county by county level. And these are small elections that are easily swingable. So get in there, throw your hat in, and make the system that you want to see. Specific to COVID, I think there are also lots of ways to help. But one of the simplest ones is donate to a bail fund so people don't have to step foot in jail when they get a bond set. Write to people in prison at any chance you can. Support the work that the ACLU, not just nationally, but at a local level, support local grassroots organizations. There's lots that you can do to impact these problems, and we can fix them.
And lastly, where can people find out more about your work as well as about these issues?
Sure. So the ACLU has a lot of resources online that can point you to some of the work that we do, as well as ways that you can get involved. But as I said, this is sort of a quintessentially local endeavor. Look up your local organizations that do criminal justice reform work, that advocate on behalf of defendants and prisoners. They can always use the help. You can volunteer with them. You can amplify their messages. You can donate. Getting involved is the best way to learn, right? And finally, read publications and people who are doing this work in real time. So online outlets like The Appeal, The Marshall Project, Crime Report, there are several others, right? National news is not good at covering criminal justice. They're just not. So you got to find the more niche publications and the activists who are doing this work, follow them on social media, get in conversations with them, take your learning to the next level and engage with the people who are doing it. That's the best way to really figure out what you don't know and how you can get involved.
Somil, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. As Somil describes, although there are some measures being implemented to mitigate the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic inside jails and prisons, the inability to practice social distancing, and the refusal of government and corrections officials to dramatically reduce the population within these facilities is ultimately exacerbating the public health crisis and worsening individual and community health. As this season comes to an end, we hope that you've started to recognize that what's happening on the inside of these facilities has a profound effect on the outside and on how you yourself can be part of the solution. Like Somal stresses, if you have the capacity to vote, you have the capacity to influence who's in positions of power on a local, state, and national level. And other ways to instigate change is by bringing more people into conversations regarding these issues, donating to bail funds and other programs working to help incarcerated individuals, or volunteering with local organizations at the forefront of this work.
Yeah, so before we close out, if you haven't already, please, please, please register to vote. Many people consider the ability to vote a right, but in our country, it's actually a privilege. For example, while the rules vary state by state, most incarcerated folks lose their right to vote, and sometimes even after release, this right still isn't restored. So for those of us who are able to, it is necessary to honor this privilege because we all have the power to enact change in this country and for our communities. And with that, thank you all for an incredible season, and we'll see you in the next one.
Until then.
Women's Health Incarcerated works to raise awareness about the experiences of women within our current incarceration system, with a primary focus on health-related issues. The podcast can be found on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and if you want to learn more about our episodes, view the transcripts to see where we get our information, or find different ways that you could get involved, please visit www.winkthemovement.org. That's www.whincthemovement.org. Thank you.